When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, like Alo or Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret? With Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whatever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/try to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/try.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Friday, September 13th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about James Watkins' American remake, Speak No Evil, and we'll present interviews with James Watkins and star James McAvoy. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor BJ Colangelo.
Hi, hi, hiya.
All right, BJ, this movie is a remake of a Danish film directed by Christian Taftrup that came out just 2 years ago. I have not seen that. You have, and you're going to tell me all about the differences between the two later in this conversation. But I just think it's the fact that I haven't seen the original and therefore don't have anything to compare this to might be necessary context for my reaction to this movie. So let's get into some general thoughts before we delve into spoilers. BJ, what did you think about the 2024 version of Speak No Evil?
So I admittedly was very, very skeptical going into it because the original film is such a specific brand of bleakness. And with it coming out as quickly as it did after the original, there's always that, I think, knee-jerk reaction of, oh, this is going to be a cheap cash grab. It's just going to be, you know, a shot-for-shot remake. And, you know, what could they possibly do here that's interesting? And I was so pleasantly surprised. This is what I get for doubting James Watkins, who directed Eden Lake, a very fantastic bleak horror movie. Also, one of my favorite episodes of Black Mirror, Shut Up and Dance. So I wasn't sure what to expect. And when I watched it, I was pretty blown away, all things considered. I found it to be extremely tense, even knowing, you know, kind of what the film is about already. I thought James McAvoy was super terrifying. I am very into his performance. I think he's so, so compelling and terrifying. Mm-hmm. And then obviously Mackenzie Davis is one of my all-time favorites. So seeing her kind of go toe-to-toe with him, I thought was great. But no, I thought this movie did a really good job playing with the exercise and tension and playing with this idea of, you know, the dangers of ignoring red flags, like very obvious red flags for the sake of politeness and not wanting to, like, you know, look like you're being rude or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because of the sort of uncomfortable nature that's like baked into the premise of this movie, this is not the type of thing that I personally think I'm going to be rewatching a ton, but I thought it was very well made and super effective. And it made me feel all the things that I think the movie wanted me to feel at exactly the right times, which I think is a sign of a successful movie. I was literally like twisting and squirming in my seat at certain points. So it definitely worked on me in a very visceral way. I'm trying to think if there's anything we can really say before we dive into spoilers. I mean, I thought all the cast was really great. I don't know. Do you have anything to add before we get into like the nitty gritty of it?
I think something that we can talk about without spoilers is like this movie is very much about people who are in a situation that is very uncomfortable and everything in their body is telling them like, get out, don't do this. And then they're ignoring it for the sake of politeness. And every time I see people talking about this, they say, you know, that couldn't have been me. I wouldn't have done that. There's no way I would have gotten myself in that situation. And what I find so interesting about that is that none of us know how we are going to respond in a dangerous situation until we're actually put in that situation. You can watch a million movies and say, I know exactly what I would do in that situation. But when push comes to shove, no, you do not. Because when all of those like fight or flight senses kind of kick in, your brain gets completely overridden by just like the impulse of, I don't know what to do here. Like, it's just, in my interview, we'll talk about this later, but in my interview, I talked to James Watkins about how, you know, I've taught school shooter drills with kids in school and how awful that is. And it's like, here's the thing, you can prepare as much as you can, but once it actually happens, like protocol or whatever kind of goes out the window.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the immediate thoughts that I had when watching this trailer was, why don't these people just leave? And I thought that the movie did a pretty good job, without giving anything away, of providing quasi-convincing reasons why they keep getting pulled back into this other family's orbit. Mm-hmm. There are several instances that maybe we can talk about later where that happens, but I found myself thinking exactly what you said. Like, I would like to think if I was in that situation, I would simply continue along with the decision that I'd made to leave. But I think these moments in the movie are just convincing enough, sort of in movie logic almost, to make me not hate these characters for staying. And that's a fine line. Like, sometimes I find myself totally tapping out on being invested in movie characters if they make too many dumb decisions. And I eventually kind of end up saying to myself, like, well, at this point, you deserve whatever's going to happen to you because you're clearly an right. idiot, you know? But I never felt that way about these characters. So I don't know if that's necessarily like a testament to the writing or the performances or a combination of both or what. But yeah, what did you think about that part of it? Like, the way that these characters behave?
I honestly think that it does a little bit better of a job than the original one does, where I completely understand how they're getting sucked into this web. And I also think I have a better understanding of why these characters end up in these clutches in the first place better than I do the original film. And I think that just goes to, I think it just speaks to how effective it is when you put a story within a culture that you understand, because I am not super well versed in the culture of like Danish and the Dutch, because why would I be? I'm a filthy American, but I completely understand like why they react the way they do, what they find appealing about, you know, these new people that they've just met. Like, I understand that. Whereas I think in the other one, I don't understand it as well. Like, I get it, but it doesn't hit me in like that visceral spot the way this does, because I can absolutely put myself in Mackenzie Davis' shoes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think that's probably as far as we can go without spoilers, really. So from this point on, we're going to be spoiling the 2024 version of Speak No Evil, and just assume that we'll also include spoilers for the original movie at this point on too. So the three instances that I've written down of reasons why they would come back would be like, they have to turn around and get the little girl's doll, which totally makes sense. Mm-hmm. The Sierra character explains that her own daughter died, and that's why Agnes, the couple's daughter, was in their bed with them, which, I mean, understandably, Mackenzie Davis was very freaked out by that moment. But like, the sort of guilt trip nature of playing on and toying with their emotions in that way, in that moment when they were like out the door ready to get the hell out of there, I thought was pretty well done, and like just convincing enough to maybe understand that you could feel bad in that scenario and maybe stay. And then the last one is just when James McAvoy's character Patty throws the young boy Ant into the lake. I mean, that's such a dick move on his part, because he knows he knows that they're gonna have to do the right thing, and they can't just like leave this kid to die because he can't swim. But yeah, so I don't know, how do you want to proceed here? Do you want to jump right into the differences, or do you want to talk about like some other stuff that you think this movie does well, that now that we're in the spoiler zone, what do you think?
Well, I think so many of the things that this movie does well are spoilers compared to the original. Because, for example, in the original film, they do drown that boy. Like,
oh, wow. Okay.
He doesn't find a boy like, oh, no, I can't swim. He finds a dead child. So like right off the rip, let's just pull that Band-Aid off. The original movie is so bleak, like unrelentingly bleak, and to a point that I think a lot of people reject the movie with how bleak it is, because it's like, I can't believe this is happening. This is so demented. And I know some people who have said that because of how bleak it gets towards the end, it feels very unearned. Whereas I think this new movie, I completely understand how we get from point A to point B to point C the entire movie. So in the 2022 version, After they find the kid's body, that's kind of the oh shit moment of like, this is very serious. We have got to get out of here. The car breaks down when dad's trying to escape. He goes back to the house and he finds his family like trapped in the, like the evil guy's car. And then the parents have to sit and watch as they cut out daughter Agnes's tongue.
Oh no. Wow.
Yeah. So they watch it happen. Oh, don't worry. It gets worse. And so then the bad couple drives the parents to a quarry, strips them naked, makes them walk into the quarry, and then stones them to death.
Oh, Jesus. Wow.
So it is like this like long walk of just like for like the last like 15, 20 minutes. It's just the worst thing you've ever seen. It's so dark. And so when they announced this remake, a lot of people were like, oh my God, there's no way in hell like they're going to be able to do that ending for a studio movie. And I at first was like, yeah, they're not going to be able to do that. And that's going to feel like a cop out. And then I watched what they did with this new one. And I was like, no, this actually makes sense. I don't believe that a character like Mackenzie Davis would have allowed herself to get taken into a quarry where she's stoned to death. Like, I don't think that's going to happen. I think that she would punch someone in the face. And so yeah. I was like, this makes way more sense to me because it's taking a very similar situation, but showing how two different cultures are going to, you know, have that same conflict and how it's going to play out differently. And so I was really impressed with Speak No Evil 2024 in that I do think that these parents would be fighting. I also think that the kids would be the one trying to, you know, get the message out, because in the original one, it's the dad who finds the cabin with all of like the stuff that's proof that they're serial killers. But I liked 2024 being kids. Like, I like that this kid was like, no, you're the ally I have. This is how I'm going to get through to you. And that, you know, this is an American family that is way more intact, like in tune with their daughter's like emotional needs, which is why she has, you know, the emotional support stuffed animal bunny rabbit that they like can't leave without. So yeah, they are going to listen to her and they are going to like do what they can to like make sure they get out. So I totally bought into what this new version is doing. I even put in my review, while I hope this does not happen, it definitely does make the argument that like you could keep telling this story and just pair up random people from different parts of the world over and over and over again, because they will never react in those situations the same way.
Yeah, that's so fascinating, because from the sound of it, it completely changes what kind of movie it even is. Like the way that you described that original film, and I remember people reacting to it. I never knew what happened at the ending of the 2022 version, but I remember people being like, this is real sicko shit, you know, like this is like for like the hardcore like horror audience or whatever. And I was always curious about it, but I just like don't subscribe to Shudder. And so I don't, you're missing out. Like, I know. I probably need to just bite the bullet on that. But like the way that you're describing the ending of that movie, it sounds like it is a movie kind of about, or at least it leans into extremity. And you know much more about the horror genre than I do, but there's like a whole world of horror movies that rely on that in a big way. And this sounds like it's the original film at least has one toe in that pond, so to speak. And this movie does not feel like that at all. It feels like more of a thriller than a movie that is reveling in the extremity of it all. So it's fascinating that it like altered the DNA of the movie in such a big way by changing the culture around it or whatever. So
yeah. And I mean, the scenes that they have that are the same also have like this very different tone to them. So for example, the screaming scene, which I think is like the male version of the screaming scene in Midsommar. Like that's what it feels like to me. Both movies have that, where it's like, no, you need to get out and you need to scream and you need to like feel primal and, you know, whatever, whatever. And in this new one, you can just tell that like you're witnessing somebody release themselves from like the awful, like oppressive nature that is like the way the patriarchy forces men to act and how they make them feel, because we don't let men feel their emotions in our culture. And like Scoot McNairy is so good in that scene. And I just like, I love it. I love how they do it. I love the way that James McAvoy takes Patty as this like very charming kind of like alpha male guy, because those guys exist. And I think we've all like met a guy like that where it's like, this guy's a real piece of shit, but like, I get why they always have a girlfriend, you know? And it's like, mm-hmm. because they're so charming, but you're like, God, but you're such a walking red flag. And I don't know. I just really thought they did a good job. I was shocked at how good they did. But again, like that, I should not have doubted James Watkins. I think that he's brilliant and he is so good at reveling in this like very uncomfortable stuff. Like going back to his Black Mirror episode. Most people don't know the names of Black Mirror, but Shut Up and Dance is the one about internet trolling. And the reveal at the end of that episode is crazy pants. and so like this just feels right at home for him. And it works. It works really well. And I think the ending, while not nearly as bleak as the original one, watching a kid smash James McAvoy's head with a rock is still pretty intense.
Yeah. I loved the ending of this movie. Like the final act, by the time that final act comes around, the movie basically has turned into Straw Dogs, but without the sexual assault.
Totally.
If you felt that as well. Like it's challenging Scoot McNairy's character's masculinity and showing Mackenzie Davis as the one who's willing to really get her hands dirty to protect her family.
Totally. Like it very much has that sort of tone to it. Like it does feel like this movie is going from being this like very tense thriller into kind of like a 70s exploitation film. Like it just pivots into that realm. And again, I think that just speaks to kind of like the Americanness of it. And I don't think that it's a bad thing that it changed this culture, because honestly, like I just can't imagine Americans ending up in the same circumstances as the first one. I think that we're shittier people, if that's like if that's okay to say, but like there's like a length to our politeness. Like we are not nearly as polite as other cultures, and so like yeah, we're gonna get combative after a certain point in a way that I think a lot of other people won't, because we're entitled jerks.
Yeah, I wrote that down in my notes as like, from my understanding, a big part of the original movie is tapping into the pressures of what it means to exist in a society and the unspoken demands that we make of each other to constantly be polite and civil. And this movie taps into that a little bit, specifically with the whole forcing the vegetarian to eat meat thing. But mm-hmm. I personally didn't think that idea, which is what I thought like the whole film was about, was really explored a ton in this iteration. Mm-hmm. There's that moment at the end when Scoot McNairy says, "Why are you doing this to us?" And James McAvoy answers, "Because you let us." Mm-hmm. And part of me understood that, but another part of me was wishing the film had gone a little further down that road, if you know what I mean. So I'd love to know if you have any other thoughts about that.
Yeah. So that line, like that's the big line in the original one. It's kind of like the stranger's version of like, "Because you were home." Like it's, they say the same thing, like right before they stone the parents to death. It's like, but it comes from like the wife is like, "Why are you doing this?" It's like, "Because you let us." And it's like, mm-hmm. in that situation, I'm very much like, you did. You absolutely let them, for sure. You did not push back on this at all. Whereas in this, I think so much of the conflict comes from also trying to figure out how you're going to push back against them. It's like playing that psychological 3D chess of how do I deal with this situation? And this doesn't sound really awful. I do think that in today's day and age, I think the overwhelming number of Americans do know how to play this game very well, because we unfortunately live in a society where it's like, if somebody's got road rage or whatever, somebody's being a jerk at a store, we have the constant threat of like, that person might have a gun. Like that person might kill us. So we have to constantly do like risk assessment with every interaction we have with a stranger. And so that will make you react differently in these situations, which is why I like that there is like more of an active presence with, you know, pushing back against them towards the end of this. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I do think that like the "because you let us" line doesn't hit quite as hard, I think, as it did in the original, if only because it's like, well, they didn't let you. Like, they tried for a little bit there.
Yeah, and it almost seems like by those characters getting stoned at the end, and like being stripped down to nothing and just standing there and taking these rocks being hurled at them. It sounds like the movie is really hitting you over the head with that point specifically, the you didn't push back, you let this happen thing. Mm-hmm. And it seems like this movie is not trying to moralize is the wrong word, but like not try to underline the point that it's trying to make in such a, you know, it's not circling it and underlining it and like drawing a highlighter and putting a bunch of exclamation points around the point that it's trying to make, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes total sense.
Okay, so I guess let's take a break and then we'll come back and get into your interviews.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
All right, so you had the chance to speak to James Watkins, the director of this movie. Anything that you want to mention here before we throw it to that?
I like love talking to directors who make deeply messed up movies, solely because they're always the nicest person. They're always so kind and so generous, and that was very true for James Watkins. And so I think people might be caught off guard once they've seen this movie and once if they're familiar with his work, hearing just how lovely he is.
Excellent. All right, well, here is BJ's chat with James Watkins.
So my first question for you is that this is not your first time playing in a sandbox that already has built-in audience familiarity. Do you find it to be a stressful challenge, an exciting challenge, or something else entirely?
I'm going to go with exciting challenge. I mean, there's always stress in anything that when you're making a movie, but I like to try and sort of lean into the positives and say, what can you know, what when I saw Christian's movie and I saw a brilliant movie, and my first film, Eden Lake, was a similarly dark, gnarly movie with a very bleak ending. But I wanted to, you know, Christian's movie exists, it's brilliant, but I thought if I'm going to get involved with this, it's got to speak to me in a way that I want it to speak, you know? And I wanted to sort of say, okay, can I reimagine or at least have my own, get my sticky fingers into it and do something slightly different? And by relocating it to the UK, have different characters, different, you know, different nationalities and cultural perspectives and mindsets and Brits and their humor and Americans mm-hmm. and how they might react to threat, I think being very different to how Europeans might and stuff like that. So, yeah, it was just seemed like such a rich setup and such a rich theme to explore within a kind of context of a horror thriller.
Absolutely. And this is a film that has the original Christian's film has such a notoriously shocking ending to it.
Yeah.
And so then it made me think like, well, how do you know which elements and which story beats you want to maintain in order to like, you know, keep the integrity of the story? Or how do you decide what to keep and what to make your own?
It's just about what speaks to you. What was great when I spoke to Blumhouse about it was there was no cynicism to it. There was no, like, we're trying to contrive something for an American. It was none of that. You know, first off, I said, can I set this in the UK? And that, because if you want to set it with a couple from New York going to West Virginia, I don't know how to write that because I don't know those people. Mm-hmm. But if I can set it in my world, I know people like Paddy. I can create that character and I know the cultural cringe. I know that cultural cringe between Brits and Americans and how they kind of might misread the signals. I can just get into that. So, I mean, there's so much brilliant stuff in Christian's movie, which I was like, okay, yeah, this is great, this is great, this is great. And then within it, just going, where do these characters take me? It was very organic, really. It was just like, okay, I want to lean more into that theme here. I want to get a bit more here. I definitely wanted to go somewhere different in the third act. Mm-hmm. Because for me, once the cat's out the bag, you know, the point when Paddy says, look, because you let us, mm-hmm. the theme of the movie, Christian's film theme that takes all the way through to the end, in my mind, particularly with these American characters, I felt that once it was all out there and it's no longer about politeness, when you're confronted with a gun, mm-hmm. you know, politeness is not, you know, so it was sort of like I felt these characters, Ben and Louise, they've got to at least try to do something, you know, to run, to hide, to whatever. And I thought that was an American mindset. I just, when confronted with mortal danger and their child, mm-hmm. I wanted that. But also I wanted to say thematically a different thing, which is when, you know, forget polite, there is polite society in that theme, but then when you get into the converse of polite society is that none of us really are used to violence.
Right.
And so in our civilized world, when we're confronted with violence, how do we react? And I deliberately didn't want Ben and Louise to be militarized or, you know, they're pretty, you know, fumbly in the way they do it with the Molotov and with everything. And also these kind of notions of masculinity that Ben's been tracking in terms of, you know, he thinks that this toxic mentor, toxic masculine mentor of Paddy is going to solve his problems. But ultimately, it's a complete lie, obviously. And Ben isn't that guy. He's much more beta than his wife, mm-hmm. who's much more alpha. You know, these things are not gendered. It's just nonsense. So, you know, I just wanted to kind of get into that a little bit, if you know what I mean.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's a really brilliant observation, especially because, you know, I used to be a teacher, which meant I've had to teach school shooting drills to children.
Yeah.
And there's only so much, you know, preparation that you can have. But once you're actually in that position, you're faced with that danger, everything you've learned goes out the window.
Totally.
So, you know, having these characters, you know, not knowing what to do in the face of danger, I think is precisely how they would respond. You know, everybody loves to watch a movie and think, oh, I would have done this. No, you wouldn't have.
No, like, I agree.
Yeah, James McAvoy has a gun in your face. You're not doing that. That's not happening.
I agree. Totally. No, that's really interesting.
And so throughout your work, which I'm a very big fan of your work, you play in such dark sandboxes all the time. And one in particular, the Shut Up and Dance episode of Black Mirror, which I view as one of the greatest, you know, entries that they've ever had, is such an exercise in subversion just to then kick you right in the gut at the end. And I feel like this movie does a little bit of that as well. There's a lot of subversion and it just like gets you. What is it about these types of stories that attracts you to them?
Yeah, I don't know consciously. I think it's something about we live in an age of anxiety, and there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of anxiousness, there's a lot of troubles in the world and things and how we react and how we, and I like films that, you know, horror films or thrillers or whatever that are about something, that tap into concerns that we all have. I think it's just much more relatable. So I kind of like to scratch away at those concerns. And for me, that's much more interesting than a kind of clockwork horror or jump scares. You know, if you could kind of watch it and go, yeah, that speaks to me, those concerns, that situation, what would I do? I suppose that in some way, I mean, the darkness, I don't know. But, you know, they're all those transgressive elements or whatever, I always find really interesting.
I'm the same way. That's why I consume so much horror, because I'm just fascinated by it. It's
so
different from the way that I think and process.
Yeah.
And I think that might be what draws me into it.
Yeah, it's much more interesting also seeing dysfunction than function.
Absolutely. And so speaking to you as a writer on this project, this is such a phenomenally well-cast movie, and they are all firing on all cylinders. Are these the characters, like when you were writing this, this is how you imagined them, or did they transform into something better once you got on set and you had this cast?
A bit of both. I mean, it was a dream cast, and I really, you know, I'm fans of all those people, and so I sort of went after my kind of fan choices, and it was great to get them. But then definitely, once we got into, we rehearsed, so we did like, you know, a good week sitting in a room, not acting, but talking, turning through the pages of the script, talking about character, making notes. And so that all fed into and helped enrichen the characters, and I'm quite loose in terms of how I direct, so it's much more like, I'm not like, okay, just say the words on the page. You know, it's like, I'm actually, because I've written it, I'm quite, you know, like, look, you know what, if that's not working, cross it out, we'll rewrite it, it's fine. You know, and so that definitely fed into the process, both in rehearsal and then on set. So it was, I'll give you an example. So like, James came up with an idea that he thought, wouldn't it be great if Aisling started finishing some of his sentences, Mm-hmm. So it plays both in terms of the intimacy of their relationship, but also the kind of con artistry of the two of them. And it was great. So he would kind of like give a line, he'd start a line and she'd finishing it. And you know, and how well they know each other almost as well. There's such intimacy there. So all the sexuality of that, you know, James and Ashley, I'm sure they've said, you know, they kind of amplified that in terms of, you know, so you've got this bad couple and it's clearly horrendous, you know, dysfunction and abuse and coercion and whatever. But at the same time, there's also kind of a love between them, you know, that's real and that the other couple are looking at. And that's not fake, it's real. And the two things can be true at once. So it just makes for a much more interesting, you know, bad guys. They're not just like, you know, moustache twirling, you know. There's a real psychology and depth to their relationship, I suppose.
Oh, yeah, watching the two of them, it very much feels like I am looking into seasoned pros. This is not their first rodeo. They've done this plenty of times.
Yeah.
And they're such an enjoyment. They're reveling in the things that they're doing.
Yeah, so, yeah, totally.
Absolutely. Yeah. So my last question for you is that what sort of conversations are you hoping audiences start to have after watching?
Well, I'd love the conversation to be, didn't I have a fabulous time in the cinema? I'll tell my friends to go and see it. That would be great. But also, yeah, in terms of their everyday lives, you know, just to say, oh, yeah, you know, I know a guy like Paddy, or I've been in that situation. Yeah, or I've been in the pub sat next to that guy, and oh, God, and I couldn't get away. And he was great first, and then it got too much. Or, you know, there's a relatability to it. I call it like a way homer. You know, you can talk about it, or you can go in the bar and have a gin and tonic and you can kind of go, oh, yeah, let's just have a bit of chit-chat about the movie. You know, it's just got a bit more, hopefully, texture to it that relates to people's lives as well as giving people a blast in the cinema.
Fantastic. Well, that's my time with you today. Thank you so much for chatting.
Lovely.
And then speaking of James's, you also had a chance to talk to James McAvoy, who was so good in this movie. I know we talked about it a little bit earlier, but like, he is just unhinged in the best possible way. I really, really like him as an actor and like watching him especially get to chew on some scenery like he does in this movie. And then he also has that like really terrifying physicality, especially at the end when he's like stomping around the house at night and he looks just yoked and he's got a gun and he's just wandering around and it just feels like he's the monster out of Split or something, come back to life or whatever. It's incredible. So anything you want to say to tee up this James McAvoy conversation?
It is so fascinating to me that he did not see the original movie before this. And we talk about it in the thing, but he very much was like, yeah, if I would have seen the original, I probably wouldn't have done this movie, which I think is like very interesting. But like, he put in so much work to really get in the mind of this character. And he just really is one of our like great working actors. And I love that he continues to stick with genre films.
Amazing. All right. Here is BJ's chat with James McAvoy.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Wonderful, wonderful. Glad to hear it. So my first question is, do you know how scary you are in this movie?
I watched it with an audience a couple of nights ago in San Diego, and yeah, I got a sense through them that they found it quite scary at times.
Oh yeah, absolutely terrifying. You did a fantastic job because I had both sensations of like, one, like, oh, let me at him, gotta take him down, and then also like, I will lose this fight. I need to like sit back.
He's also kind of funny as well, which is weird because like he's such a bigot. He's an asshole. He's got the worst kind of opinions about fucking politics, gender politics, everything. And yet you're kind of like enjoying being with him and you're like, ah, this feels horrible.
Yeah.
And I'm still laughing at him. It's weird.
Yeah, it's a total mind trip to sit in that world. And so one of the questions I have for you is that this is obviously a character that exists from another film and this is not,
there was a prequel? What? Are we talking multidimensional here or like?
Oh my, could you imagine if there was like a Speaking of Evil multiverse? That would just be,
that'd be
the bleakest multiverse ever created.
Pattyverse. Come on. Tongueless verse.
But this is, you know, not the first time that you've played a character that exists either in another film or a book. In many cases, characters that are already beloved. So when you prepare for a role like this, do you watch the source material? You just build it from the ground up?
I was really glad I hadn't seen the original film. If I had have seen it, I might not have taken this role. So, no, I actively chose not to watch the original until we were finished making our version of it.
Oh, that's incredible. How do you feel about your character and what you brought to it now that you have seen the original?
I'm really proud of what we did. I'm really proud of the humor in it. I'm really proud of the tension in the film, because we managed to somehow the film gets like drawn like a bow, so tight. By about an hour in, it's just like shaking. You feel that the bow's going to break or the arrow's going to get loose. And yet there's a lot of laughs along the way and there's a lot of scares along the way. And yet somehow you'd think they would dissipate the tension every time that happens, but they don't. Somehow everyone goes, oh, whoa! And it kind of ramps up. Each time it kind of ramps up and ramps up and ramps up. And that's testament to James Watkins, the director. He managed to orchestrate and calibrate this really fine tightrope walk where we had sort of levity on one side and scariness and fear and frights on the other side. And yet he managed to walk this line where both things managed to coexist without dissipating the other. And it was really deft from him.
Absolutely. And like the levity in this movie almost feels like it has an asterisk because you can just sense that this humor that's coming is, there's a lot of uncomfortability with that humor and having to sit in it. And this film has so much to say about both the art of politeness in polite society and the things that we are willing to ignore in the face of politeness, but also there's some very fascinating stuff about masculinity in here.
Yeah, totally.
And I would love for you to talk about, you know, what it was like playing in these very complicated sandboxes.
Listen, I mean, I regularly do walk away from people like Paddy as well. I'm not talking about murderers and kidnappers and people like that, but as soon as you get guys giving it like that like, here's the thing about me, do you know what I mean? Or something, let me put you straight here, okay? And you're just like, fuck off. I don't like being around it. Really enjoyed examining and getting to play somebody like that. But it's, you've got two kind of versions of masculinity in the film. You've got this kind of beta masculine, they've got this kind of alpha masculine. And I'm sure there's a version of alpha masculinity which is also okay and nice and in some way great. But this is a very toxic version of it. Mm-hmm. But then you've got a beta masculine guy here as well, but he's fucking toxic as well. Because he's not spreading health in his life or in his family. He's helping that toxic environment, which is, you think, surely that's a different thing. It's because it's not front-footed. But you've got this guy who's sitting there, can't look at himself in the mirror as a professional, can't look at himself in the mirror as a husband, as a father, as just a man. He feels like he's failing on every level. And so you get this guy who comes, yes, he's toxic, yes, he's dick swinging, but really, he's projecting positivity and happiness, and it seems genuine. And I actually think it is genuine. He's genuinely capable of being jolly and genuinely happy. And why wouldn't somebody as vulnerable as Ben look at that person and go, he's got the answers. I want to try and get like him, even though he would never at any other time in his life subscribe to these toxic views. It helps me to understand a little bit why these people online are appealing to so many young men at the moment that are growing these the worst possible opinions and the worst possible sort of relationships now because of it and the way that they're behaving towards people. Anyway, it was interesting to play with that dynamic between two grown men as well, not just kids, but two middle-aged men.
Absolutely. I think, I mean, when we talk about the patriarchy, we often forget how much the patriarchy hurts men and hurts young
Absolutely.
Men as well. And I love that this movie is playing with that because in both the original film and in this film, just the primal screaming, like allowing to feel, let a man feel an emotion for the love of God.
Yeah.
And getting to see that, it's this thing that it twists in your brain where I watch this and I'm like, oh, he needed that. He really needed that.
Do you know what as well? Like, I also like it because it's, Paddy is somebody who's, he's not afraid to cry. He's not afraid to feel emotion. So you look at him and you go, oh God, he's so great being vulnerable. He's so capable of being vulnerable. That's actually a modern man. That's a good version of masculinity. And you're like, kind of is, but he's still actually an asshole. Mm-hmm. I love that scene where we get to do the primal scream, simply because it cuts from just the kind of middle shot, the mid-size shot of us two, to the wide shot, and you just get this huge phallus standing up right beside us. Like, hey!
It was perfect, absolute perfect, everything about it. And so this movie, though, also, you know, it plays with so much subversion and then just kicks you in the gut towards the end of it here. I've heard that the set, though, was very lovely.
Yeah.
And everyone was very happy.
Yeah.
So how do you pull yourself out of that mindset? Are you someone who needs a decompression or are you a light switch actor?
Light switch. Honestly, since the shirt cut and I'm like, was that good? Yeah, I thought that was good. Or maybe I could go again. All right, whatever. And then it's back to me. I think I can't believe I just did that. And back to me. it's always me. It's me in the take, and it's me outside the take. And it is, I just think, save it for the take, you know what I mean? And be relaxed for the take. And you can intellectualize in between takes, but don't try and, I would never try and like be in the scene or be in the character or be in the moment, you know? I think it just creates tension and takes your eye off the storytelling ball, you know? The storytelling ball.
Fantastic. My last question for you is, you have such an interesting relationship dynamic on the screen with, specifically with Mackenzie Davis. She feels like the one that is equal with you. So what was it like working with her as, you know, the scene partner?
She's wicked, man. She's so good. And she had a really difficult job, certainly in the first half of the film as well, where her character is not so actively telling the story of the film. It's more in a passive way, mm-hmm. which is not something that I think we're used to seeing Mackenzie Davis do. Mm-hmm. Her wheelhouse is so built on like active action. So to watch her do that and still absolutely draw the audience in was brilliant. And then she takes over a bit in the second half and mm-hmm. she becomes more of the active protagonist and the leader, really. But she's brilliant. She's got such a strong presence. In fact, all four of the actors, three of the other actors that were in this little adult foursome anyway were amazing. Ashton Franciosi playing somebody who's totally been groomed into this situation and abused into this situation and yet layered it to the point that mm-hmm. you go like, I think she actually does love him though, mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. To make you even doubt at the end when she says like, I was his first, he took me when I was Agnes's age. Mm-hmm. You're like, you don't even know if she's telling the truth. I believe she is telling the truth. Mm-hmm. But you don't even know because you're like, she's played it so strongly that the love is real. Even though abuse is part of their everyday.
Yeah.
It's amazing performances, and Scoot was just incredible. The amazing thing about Scoot is, he's more the Paddy than I am. He, in real life, not a murderer, doesn't do anything like that, but like, he is man of the woods, hunter, stalker, builds his own house, can fix any car, like he is that guy. So the fact that he was playing this weak beta male figure, I was like, good on you, man, because you could out-paddy me any day.
All right, before we wrap up, any closing thoughts on Speak No Evil, either this one or the original, or anything that we didn't get a chance to talk about?
I don't know if you are aware of this, because you are fortunately not as chronically online as I am, but do you know about the constant discourse around the frequency of this trailer appearing?
I don't know about it in terms of internet discourse. I know about it in my own life where I was like, Jesus Christ, can you put me out of my misery already? I am so sick of seeing this trailer. And I actually thought that that might work against this movie, against me liking the movie, because I was so incredibly annoyed with having to see this over and over and over for what feels like months on end now. So what is the discourse? I assume it's just people ranting like I just did.
Oh, yeah, it is. Incessant. Like, people are so annoyed with this trailer. Like, people are like marking themselves safe from the trailer. People are talking about how, like, oh god, I can't wait for this movie to come out because it means we're finally free from this trailer. Like, it's very much that thing. And my feelings about it are twofold. Is that one, Blumhouse has not had a super great year, so it kind of feels like they need to make their nut on this movie, and that's probably why they pushed it so heavily. But also, I hope that it doesn't turn people away. Like, I genuinely am fearful that the oversaturation of this trailer is going to make people not want to see the movie. Please do. It is one of the best horror movies we've gotten this year. I think it's a really, it's also a great watch with a crowd. Like, this is a movie that I actively encourage people to watch with like active crowds, because there are so many moments of like, oh, hell no. Like, no, don't do that. Like, because it's so uncomfortable to watch that I definitely recommend, like, watch this with a group if you can. Like, it's, I think it's better that way.
Yeah. There's two things that I wanted to say real quick about that. One of them is that the moment where the aunt character reveals that he's had his tongue cut out, that appears in the trailer. And I remember thinking that was a huge mistake because it, like, gives the game away in a more blatant way than the sort of creepy nature of the trailer had led us to believe, you know, up until that point. And I was like, oh man, that's kind of like, that's one of those decisions that I feel like could kill people's interest in the movie. And even knowing that that happens, I still agree with you that this is absolutely worth seeing. And like, it's incredibly effective, super tense. And like, even though that moment doesn't come in until really, really late, the premise is so strong and the execution of these ideas are so strong that it's one of those rare instances where it doesn't really matter to me that, you know, something like that happened in the trailer. And then the only other thing I was going to say is that the beginning of this movie, when they're on their vacation in Italy, is just gorgeous. Like, so beautifully filmed.
Oh my God, it's so beautiful.
I don't really have any smart thoughts about it or interesting thoughts about it. I was just like, wow. Like, I think it's the opening shot. It's this, just this gigantic vista of some Italian countryside or something. And I was like, wow, this is just straight up beautiful. So they spend like a decent amount of time in Italy before things go off the rails and they go over to the James McAvoy house. But yeah, it was just really, really lovely to see. And it was like, oh, you actually went to a place and spent money to go here. And I appreciate that. So I just wanted to shout that out real quick.
Yeah, it's so beautiful. It's one of those things where in watching it, it's like, if anybody was going to be able to like guest direct an episode of The White Lotus, it should be James Watkins.
Oh yeah, that's a great call.
He can balance the beauty of this like lush, gorgeous area with just like people being monsters.
Yeah, 100%. Okay, well, I think that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about Speak No Evil, including BJ's review, at slashfilm.com. I will link to that review in the show notes as well. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really, really, really helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you all next week.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.